Chapter 14, Space Station. To Locke Erasmus at polnet.gov. From Site Post Alert, re Girl on Bridge. Now you are not in cesspool, can communicate again. Have no email here. Stones are mine. Back on bridge soon. War in earnest. Post to me only this site. Pick up name, Bridge Girl, password, not step stool.
Peter found spaceflight boring, just as he suspected he would. Like air travel, only longer, and with less scenery. Thank heaven Mother and Father had the good sense not to get all sentimental about the shuttle flight to the Ministry of Colonization. After all, it was the same space station that had been battle school. They were going to set foot at last where precious little Ender had had his first triumphs and, oh yes, killed a boy. But there were no footprints here. Nothing to tell them what it was like for Ender to ride in a shuttle to this place. They were not small children taken away from their homes. They were adults, and the fate of the world just might rest in their hands. Come to think of it, that was like Ender, wasn't it? The whole human race was united when Ender came here. The enemy was clear, the danger real, and Ender didn't even have to know what he was doing to win the war. By comparison, Peter's task was much more difficult. It might seem simpler, find a really good assassin and kill Ashiel, but it wasn't that simple. First, Ashiel, being an assassin and a user of assassins, would be ready for such a plot. Second, it wasn't enough to kill Ashiel. He was not the army that conquered India and Indochina. He was not the government that ruled more than half the people of the world. Destroy Ashiel, and you still have to roll back all the things he did. It was like Hitler back in World War II. Without Hitler, Germany would never have had the nerve to conquer France and sweep to the gates of Moscow. But if Hitler had been assassinated just before the invasion of Russia, then in all likelihood the common language of the international fleet would have been German. Because it was Hitler's mistakes, his weaknesses, his fears, his hatreds that lost the back half of the war, just as it was his drive, his decisions that won the front half. Killing Ashiel might do nothing more than guarantee a world governed by China. Still, with him out of the way, Peter would face a rational enemy, and his own assets would not be so superstitiously terrified. The way Bean and Petra and Valomi fled at the mere thought of Ashiel coming to Riberan Pretu. Though, of course, in the long run, they weren't wrong. Still, it complicated things enormously that he kept having to work alone. Unless you counted Mother and Father. And since they were the only assets he had that he could rely on to serve his interests, he definitely counted them. Counted them, but was angry at them all the same. He knew it was irrational, but the whole way up to Mincall, he kept coming back to the same seething memory of the way his parents had always judged him as a child and found him wanting. While Ender and Valentine could do no wrong, being a fundamentally reasonable person, he took due notice of the fact that since Val and Ender left in a colony ship, his parents had been completely supportive of him, had saved him more than once. He could not have asked any more from them, even if they had actually loved him. They did their duty as parents, and more than a duty. But it didn't erase the pain of those earlier years when everything he did seemed to be wrong, every natural instinct and offense against one of their versions of God or the other. Well, in all your judging, remember this. It was Ender who turned out to be Cain, wasn't it? And you always thought it was going to be me. Stupid, 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 Peter told himself. Ender didn't kill his brother. Ender defended himself against his enemies. As I have done. I have to get over this, he told himself again and again during the voyage. I wish there was something to look at besides the stupid vids, or Dad snoring, or Mother looking at me now and then, sizing me up and then winking. Does she have any idea how awful that is, how demeaning? to wink at me? What about smiling? What about looking at me with that dreamy, fond expression she used to have for Val and Ender? Of course, she liked them. Stop it. Think about what you have to do, fool. Think about what you have to write and publish as Locke and as Demosthenes, to rouse the people in the free countries, to goad the governments of the nations ruled from above. It could be no business as usual. He couldn't allow that. But it was hard to keep the people's attention on a war in which no shots were being fired, a war that took place in a faraway land. What did they care? China had no designs on Namibia or Argentina. The war was over. Why wouldn't people just shut up about it and go back to making money? That was Peter's enemy. Not Achille, ultimately. Not even China. It was the apathy of the rest of the world that played into their hands. And here am I, in space, no longer free to move about, far more dependent than I've ever been before. Because if Graf decides not to send me back to Earth, then I can't go. There's no alternative transport. He seems to be entirely on my side, but it's his former battle school brats that have his true loyalty. He thinks he can use me as I thought I could use a shield. Well, I was wrong, but probably he's right. After all the voyaging, it was so frustrating to be there and still have to wait while the shuttle did its little dance of lining up with the station dock. There was nothing to watch. They blanked the windows because it was too nauseating in zero-G to watch the Earth spin madly as the shuttle matched the rotation of the great wheel. My career might already be over. I might already have earned whatever mention I'll have in history. I might already be nothing but a footnote in other people's biographies, a paragraph in history books. Really, at this point, my best strategy for beefing up my reputation is probably to be assassinated in some colorful way. But the way things are going, I'll probably die in some tragic airlock accident while doing a routine docking at the Mincall space station. Stop wallowing, said Mother. He looked at her sharply. I'm not, he said. Good, she said. Be angry at me. That's better than feeling sorry for yourself. He wanted to snap back angrily, but he realized the futility of denying what they all knew was true. He was depressed, definitely. And yet he still had to work. Like the day of his press conference when they dragged him out of bed. Ah, he didn't want a repeat of that humiliation. He'd do his work without having to have his parents prod him like some adolescent. And he wouldn't get snippy at them when they merely told him the truth. So he smiled at her. Come on, Mother. You know that if I were on fire, nobody would so much as pee on me to put it out. Be honest, son, said his father. There are hundreds of thousands of people back on Earth who have only to be asked, and some dozens who would do it without waiting for an invitation, if they saw an opportunity. There are some good points about fame, Peter observed. And those with empty bladders would probably chip in with a little spit. This is getting quite disgusting, said Mother. You say that because it's your job to say it, said Peter. And I'm underpaid then, said Mother, because it's nearly a full-time position. Oh, your role in life, so womanly. Men need civilizing, and you're just the one to do it. I'm obviously not very good at it. At that moment, the IF sergeant, who was their flight steward, came into the main cabin and told them it was time to go. Because they docked at the center of the station, there was no gravity. They floated along, gripping handrails, as the steward flipped their bags so that they sailed through the airlock just under them. They were caught by a couple of orderlies who had obviously done this 100 times and were not the least bit impressed by having the hegemon himself come to Mincall. Though in all probability, nobody knew who they were. They were traveling under false papers, of course, but Graf had undoubtedly let someone in the station know who they really were. Probably not the orderlies, though. Not until they were down one spoke of the wheel to a level where there was a definite floor to walk on did they meet anyone of real status in the station. A man in the gray suit that served Mincall as a uniform waited at the foot of the elevator, his hand outstretched. Mr. and Mrs. Ryman, he said, I'm Under Minister Dimak, and this must be your son, Dick. P. Peter smiled wanly at the faint humor in the pseudonym Graf had arbitrarily assigned to him. Please tell me that you know who we really are so we don't have to keep up this charade, said Peter.
I know, said D-Mac softly, but nobody else on this station does. I'd like to keep it that way for now.
Graf isn't here.
The Minister of Colonization is returning from his inspection of outfitting the newest colony ship. We're 2 weeks away from the first leg on that one. Starting next week, you won't believe the traffic that'll come through here. 16 shuttles a day, and that's just for the colonists. The freighters go directly to the dry dock.
Is there, said Father innocently, a wet dock?
D-Mac grinned. Nautical terminology dies hard.
D-Mac led them along a corridor to a down tube. They slid down the pole after him. The gravity wasn't so intense yet as to make this a problem, even for Peter's parents, who were, after all, in their 40s. He helped them to step out of the shaft into a lower and therefore heavier corridor. There were old-fashioned directional stripes along the walls. Your palm prints have already been keyed, said D-Mac. Just touch here, and it will lead you to your room. This is left over from the old days, isn't it, said Father, though I don't imagine you were here when this was still...
But I was here, said D-Mac.
I was mother to groups of new kids. Not your son, I'm afraid, but an acquaintance of yours, I believe.
Peter did not want to put himself in the pathetic position of naming off battle school graduates that he knew. Mother had no such qualms.
Petra, she said. Suryawong?
D-Mac leaned in close so his voice would not have to be pitched loud enough that it might be overheard.
Bean, he said.
He must have been a remarkable boy, said Mother. Looked like a 3-year-old when he got here, said D-Mac. Nobody could believe he was old enough for this place.
He doesn't look like that now, said Peter dryly.
No, I know about his condition. It's not public knowledge, but Colonel Graf... The minister, I mean. He knows that I still care what happens to... Well, to all my kids, of course, but this one was, I imagine your son's first trainer felt much the same way about him.
I hope so, said Mother. The sentimentality was getting so sweet Peter wanted to brush his teeth. He palmed the pad by the entrance and three strips lit up.
Green, green, brown, said D-Mac. But soon you won't be needing this. It's not as if there's miles of open country here to get lost in. The stripe system always assumes that you want to go back to your room, except when you touch the pad just outside the door of your room, and then it thinks you want to go to the bathroom.
None inside the rooms, I'm afraid. It wasn't built that way. But if you want to go to the mess hall, just slap the pad twice and it'll know.
He showed them to their quarters, which consisted of a single long room with bunks in rows along both sides of a narrow aisle.
I'm afraid you'll have company for the week we're loading up the ship, but nobody will be here very long, and then you'll have the place to yourself for 3 more weeks.
You're doing a launch a month, said Peter. How exactly are you funding a pace like that?
D-Mac looked at him blankly.
I don't actually know, he said.
Peter leaned in close and imitated the voice D-Mac used for secrets.
I'm the hegemon, he said. Officially, your boss works for me.
D-Mac whispered back.
You'll save the world. We'll finance the colony program.
I could have used a little more money for my operations, I can tell you, said Peter.
Every hegemon feels that way, said D-Mac, which is why our funding does not come through you.
Peter laughed. Smart move, if you think the colonization program is very, very important.
It's the future of the human race, said D-Mac simply. The buggers, the Formix, had the right idea. Spread out as far as you can so you can't be wiped out in a single disastrous war. Not that it saved them, but we aren't hive creatures.
Aren't we? Said Father.
Well, if we are, then, who's the queen? Asked D-Mac.
In this place, said Father, I suspect it's Graf.
And we're all just his little arms and legs. And mouths, and, well, yes, of course, a little more independent, a little less obedient than the individual Formex, of course, but that's how a species comes to dominate a world the way we did, and they did. Because you know how to get a large number of individuals to give up their personal will and subject themselves to a group mind. So, this is philosophy we're doing here, said D-Mac. Or very cutting-edge science, said Father. The behavior of humans and groups, degrees of allegiance. I think about it a lot. How interesting. I see that you're not interested at all, said Father, and that I'm now in your book as an eccentric who brings up his theories, but I never do, actually. I don't know why I did just now. It's the first time I've been in Graf's house, so to speak, and meeting you was very much like visiting with him. I'm flattered, said D-Mac. John Paul, said Mother, I do believe you're making Mr. D-Mac uncomfortable. When people feel great allegiance to the community, they start to take on the mannerisms as well as the morals of their leader, said Father, refusing to give up. If their leader has a personality, said Peter. How do you get to be a leader without one? Asked Father. Ask Ashiel, said Peter. He's the opposite. He takes on the mannerisms of the people he wants to have follow him. I don't remember that one, said D-Mac. He was only here a few days before we discovered he had a track record of murder back on Earth. Someday you'll have to tell me how Bean got him to confess. He won't tell. If he won't tell, neither will I, said D-Mac. How loyal, said Father. Not really, said D-Mac. I just don't know myself. I know it had something to do with the ventilation shaft. That confession, said Peter. The recordings wouldn't still be here, would they? No, they wouldn't, said D-Mac. And even if they were, they're part of a sealed juvenile record of a mass murderer. We only notice laws when they act against our interest, said D-Mac. See? Said Father, we've traded philosophies. Like tribesmen swapping at a potlatch, said D-Mac. If you don't mind, I'd like to have you talk with Security Chief Upanat before dinner.
What about?
The colonists aren't a problem. They have a one-way flow and they can't easily communicate planet-side, but you're probably going to be recognized here. And even if you're not, it's hard to maintain a false story for long.
Then let's not have a false story, said Peter. No, let's have a really good one, said Mother.
Let's just not talk to anybody, said Father.
Those are precisely the issues that Major Upanat wants to discuss with you.
Once D-Mac had left, they chose bunks at the back of the long room. Peter took a top bunk, of course, but while he was unloading his bags into the locker in the wall behind the bunk, Father discovered that each set of six bunks, three on each side, could be separated from the others by a privacy curtain.
Has to be a retrofit, said Father. I can't believe they would let the kids seal themselves off from each other.
How soundproof is this material? Asked Mother. Father pulled it around in a circular motion so it irised shut with him on the other side. They heard nothing from him. Then he dilated it open.
Well, he asked.
Pretty effective sound barrier, said Mother.
You did try to talk to us, didn't you? Asked Peter.
No, I was listening for you.
Well, we were listening for you, John Paul, said Mother.
No, I spoke. I didn't shout, but you couldn't hear me, right?
Peter, said Mother, you just got moved to the next compartment over.
That won't work when the colonists come through.
You can come back and sleep in Mommy's and Daddy's room when the visitors come, said Mother.
You'll have to walk through my room in order to get to the bathroom, said Peter.
That's right, said Father. I know you're hegemon and should have the best room, but then we're not likely to walk in on you making love.
Don't count on it, said Peter sourly. We'll open the door and just say a little knock-knock before we come through, said Mother. It'll give you time to smuggle your best pal out of sight.
It made him faintly nauseated to be having this discussion with his parents.
Oh, you too. You're just so cute.
I'm really glad to change rooms here, believe me. It was good to have solitude once the door was closed.
even if the price of it was moving all his stuff out of the locker he had just loaded and putting it in a locker in the next section. Now he got a lower bunk, for one thing. And for another thing, he didn't have to put up with listening to his parents trying to cheer him up. He had to have thinking time. So, of course, he promptly fell asleep. D-Mac woke him by speaking to him over the intercom. "Mr. Ryman, are you there?" It took Peter a split second to remember that he was supposed to be Dick Raymond.
"Yes, unless you want my father."
"Already spoke to him," said D-Mac. "I've keyed the guard bars to lead you to the security department." It was on the top level, with the lowest gravity, which made sense, because if security action were required, officers dispersing from the main office would have a downhill trip to wherever they were going. When they stepped inside the office, Major Upanad was there to greet them. He offered his hand to all of them. "Are you from India?" asked Mother, or Pakistan?"
"India," said Upanad, not breaking his smile at all.
I'm so sorry for your country," said Mother. "I haven't been back there since, in a long time. I hope your family is faring well under Chinese occupation."
"Thank you for your concern," said Upanad, in a tone of voice that made it clear this topic was finished.
He offered them chairs and sat down himself behind his desk, taking full advantage of his official position. Peter resented it a little, since he had spent a good while now as the man who was always in the dominant place. He might not have had much actual power as hegemon, but protocol always gave him the highest place. But he was not supposed to be known here, so he could hardly be treated differently from any civilian visitor. "I know that you are particular guests of the minister," said Upanad, "and that you wish your privacy to be undisturbed. What we need to discuss is the boundary of your privacy. Are your faces likely to be recognized?"
Possibly, said Peter.
"Especially his," he pointed to his father. This was a lie, of course, and probably futile, but...
"Ah," said Upanad, "and I assume your real names would be recognized."
"Likely," said father.
"Certainly," said mother, as if she were proud of the fact, and rather miffed that he had cast any doubt on it at all.
"So... should meals be brought to you? Do we need to clear the corridors when you go to the bathroom?"
Sounded like a nightmare to Peter.
"Major Upanad, we don't want to advertise our presence here, but I'm sure your staff can be trusted to be discreet."
"On the contrary," said Upanad. "Discreet people make it a point not to take the staff's loyalty for granted."
"Including yours?" asked Mother sweetly.
"Since you have already lied to me repeatedly," said Upanad, "I think it's safe to say that you are taking no one's loyalty for granted."
"Nevertheless," said Peter, "I'm not going to stay cooped up in that tube. I'd like to be able to use your library, I'm assuming you have one, and we can take our meals in the mess hall and use the toilet without inconveniencing others."
"There, you see," said Upanad, "you are simply not security-minded."
"We can't live here as prisoners," said Peter.
"He didn't mean that," said Father. "He was talking about the way you simply announced the decision for the three of us. So much for me being the one most likely to be recognized."
Upanad smiled. "The recognition problem is a real one," he said. "I knew you at once from the vids, Mr. Hegemon." Peter sighed and leaned back. "Your face is not as recognizable as if you were an actual politician," said Upanad. "They thrive on putting their faces before the public. Your career began, if I remember correctly, in anonymity."
"But I've been on the vids," said Peter.
"Listen," said Upanad, "few on our staff even watch the vids. I happen to be a news addict, but most people here have rather cut their ties with the gossip of Earth. I think your best way to remain undercover here is to behave as if you had nothing to hide. Be a bit standoffish. Don't get into conversations with people that lead to mutual explanations of what you do and who you are, for instance. But if you're cheerful and don't act mysterious, you should be fine. People won't expect to see the hegemon living with his parents in one of the bunk rooms here," Upanad grinned. "It will be our little secret, the six of us." Peter did the count. Him, his parents, Upanad, D-Mac, and... Graf, of course. I think there will be no assassination attempt here, said Upanad, because there are very few weapons on board, and all are kept under lock and key. And everybody coming up here is scanned for weaponry, so I suggest you not attempt to carry sidearms. You are trained in hand-to-hand combat?
No, said Peter.
There is a gym on the bottom level, very well equipped, and not just with child-sized devices either. The adults also need to stay fit. You should use the facility to maintain your bone mass and so forth, but also we can arrange martial arts classes for you if you are interested.
I'm not interested, said Peter, but it sounds like a good idea.
Anyone they sent against us, though, said Mother, will be very much better trained in it than we will.
Perhaps so, perhaps not, said Upanad. If your enemies attempt to get you here, they will have to rely on someone they can get through our screening. People who seem particularly athletic are subject to special scrutiny. We are, you see, paranoid about one of the anti-colonization groups getting someone up here just to perform an act of sabotage or terrorism.
Or assassination, you see, said Upanad. But I assure you, I and my staff are very thorough. We never leave anything unchecked.
In other words, you knew who we were before we walked in the door. Before your shuttle took off, actually, said Upanad. Or at least I had a fairly good guess.
They said their goodbyes, then settled into the routine of life in a space station. Day and night were kept on Greenwich time for no particular reason but that it was at zero longitude and they had to pick some time. Peter found that his parents were not so awfully intrusive as he had feared, and he was relieved that he could not hear their lovemaking or their conversations about him through the divider. What he did, mostly, was go to the library and write. Essays, of course, on everything for every conceivable forum. There were plenty of publications that were happy to have pieces from Locke or Demosthenes, especially now that everyone knew these identities belonged to the hegemon. With most serious work appearing first on the nets, there was no way to target particular audiences. But he still talked about subjects that would have particular interest in various regions. The aim of everything he wrote was to fan the flames of suspicion of China and Chinese ambitions. As Demosthenes, he wrote quite directly about the danger of allowing the conquest of India and Indochina to stand, with a lot of who's next rhetoric. Of course, he couldn't stoop to any serious rabble-rousing, because every word he said would be held against the hegemon. Life was so much easier when he was anonymous on the nets. As Locke, however, he wrote statesmanlike, impartial essays about problems that different nations and regions were facing. Locke almost never wrote against China directly, but rather took it for granted that there would be another invasion, and that long-term investments in probable target countries might be unwise, that sort of thing. It was hard work, because every essay had to be made interesting, original, important, or no one would pay attention to it. He had to make sure he never sounded like someone riding a hobby horse. Rather, the way Father had sounded when he started spouting off about his theories of group loyalty and character to Dimak. Though, to be fair, he'd never heard Father do that before. It still gave him pause and made him realize how easily Locke and Demosthenes, and therefore Peter Wiggin himself, could become at first an irritant, at last a laughingstock. Father called this process Stassinization, and made various suggestions for essay topics, some of which Peter used. As to what Father and Mother did with their days when they weren't reading his essays and commenting on them, catching errors, that sort of thing, well, Peter had no idea. Maybe Mother had found somebody's room to clean. Graf stopped in for a brief visit on their first morning there, but then was off again, returned to Earth, in fact, on the shuttle that had brought them. He did not return for 3 weeks, by which time Peter had written nearly 40 essays, all of which had been published in various places. Most of them were Locke's essays, and as usual, most of the attention went to Demosthenes. When Graf returned, he invited them to dine with him in the minister's quarters, and they had a convivial dinner during which nothing important was discussed. Whenever the subject seemed to be turning to a matter of real moment, Graf would interrupt with a pouring of water or a joke of some kind, only rarely the funny kind. This puzzled Peter,
because surely Graf could count on his own quarters being secure. But apparently not, because after dinner he invited them on a walk, leading them quickly out of the regular corridors and into some of the service passages. They were lost almost at once, and when Graf finally opened a door and took them into a wide ledge overlooking a ventilation shaft, they had lost all sense of direction except, of course, where down was. The ventilation shaft led down a very long way. "This is a place of some historical importance," said Graf, "though few of us know it." "Ah," said Father knowingly. And because he had guessed it, Peter realized it should be guessable. And so he guessed. "Achille was here," he said. "This," said Graf, "is where Bean and his friends tricked Achille. Achille thought he was going to be able to kill Bean here, but instead Bean got him in chains, hanging in the shaft. He could have killed Achille. His friends recommended it."
"Who were the friends?" asked Mother.
"He never told me, but that's not surprising. I never asked. I thought it would be wiser if there were never any kind of record, even inside my head, of which other children were there to witness Achille's humiliation and helplessness. It would have mattered if he had simply killed Achille. There would have been no murders." "But you see," said Graft, "if Achille had died, then I would have had to have asked those names, and Bean could not have been allowed to remain in battle school. We might have lost the war because of that, because Ender relied on Bean quite heavily."
"You let Ender stay after he killed a boy?" said Peter.
"The boy died accidentally," said Graf, "as Ender defended himself."
"Defended himself because you left him alone," said Mother.
"I've already faced trial on those charges, and I was acquitted."
"But you were asked to resign your commission," said Mother.
"But I was then given this much higher position as Minister of Colonization. Let's not quibble over the past. Bean got Achille here not to kill him, but to induce him to confess. He did confess, very convincingly. And because I heard him do it, I'm on his death list too."
"Then why are you still alive?" asked Peter.
"Because, contrary to widespread belief, Achille is not a genius, and he makes mistakes. His reach is not infinite, and his power can be blocked. He doesn't know everything. He doesn't have everything planned. I think half the time he's winging it, putting himself in the way of opportunity, seizing it when he sees it."
"If he's not a genius, then why does he keep beating geniuses?" asked Peter.
"Because he does the unexpected," said Graf. "He doesn't actually do things remarkably well. He simply does things that no one thought he would do. He stays a jump ahead. And our finest minds were not even thinking about him when he brought off his most spectacular successes. They thought they were civilians again when he had them kidnapped. Bean wasn't trying to oppose Achille's plans during the war. He was trying to find and rescue Petra. You see, I have Achille's test scores. He's a champion suck-up, and he's very smart, or he wouldn't have got here. He knew how to ace a psych test, for instance, so that his violent tendencies remained hidden from us when we chose him to come in the last group we brought to battle school. He's dangerous, in other words. But he's never had to face an opponent, not really. What the Formex faced, he's never had to face."
"So you're confident," said Peter.
"Not at all," said Graf. "But I'm hopeful." "You brought us here just to show us this place," said Father. "Actually, no, I brought you here because I came up early in the day and swept it personally for eavesdropping devices. Plus, I installed a sound damper here so that our voices are not carrying down the ventilation shaft."
"You think Mincall has been penetrated," said Peter.
"I know it has," said Graf. "Upanad was doing his routine scan of the logs of outgoing messages, and he found an odd one that was sent within hours of your arrival here. The entire message consisted of the single word, on. Upanad's routine scan, of course, is more thorough than most people's desperate search. He found this one simply by looking for anomalies in message length, language patterns, etc., to find codes, you see."
"And this was in code?" asked Father.
Not a cipher, no, and impossible to decode for that reason. It could simply mean affirmative, as in mission is on. Might be a foreign word. There are several dozen common languages in which on has meaning by itself. It might be no, backward. You see the problem. What alerted Upanad, besides its brevity, was the fact that it was sent within hours of your arrival, after your arrival, and both the sender and the receiver of the message were anonymous. How could the sender be anonymous from a secure military design facility? Asked Peter. Oh, it's quite simple, really, said Graf. The sender used someone else's sign-on.
Whose?
Upanad was quite embarrassed when he showed me the printout of the message, because as far as the computer was concerned, it was sent by Upanad himself. Someone got the log on of the head of security, said Father. Humiliating, you may be sure, said Graf.
You fired him? Asked Mother.
That would not make us more secure, to lose the man who was our best defense against whatever operation that message triggered.
So you think it is the English word on, and it means somebody is preparing to move against us?
I think that's not unlikely. I think the message was sent in the clear. It's only undecipherable because we don't know what on is.
And you've taken into account, said Mother, the possibility that Upanad actually sent this message himself, and is using the fact that he told you about it as a cover for the fact that he's the perpetrator. Graf looked at her a long time, blinked, and then smiled.
I was telling myself, suspect everybody, but now I know what a truly suspicious person is.
Peter hadn't thought of it either, but now it made perfect sense.
Still, let's not leap to conclusions either, said Graf. The real sender of the message might have used Major O'Ponard's sign-on precisely so that the chief of security would be our prime suspect. How long ago did he find this message? Asked Father. A couple of days, said Graf. I was already scheduled to come, so I stuck to my schedule. No warnings? No, said Graf. Any departure from routine would let the sender know his signal was discovered and perhaps interpreted, would lead him to change his plans.
So what do we do? Asked Peter.
First, said Graf, I apologize for thinking you'd be perfectly safe here. Apparently our shield's reach, or perhaps China's, is longer than we thought. So do we go home? Asked Father. Second, said Graf, we can't do anything that would play into their hands. Going home right now before the threat can be identified and neutralized would expose you to greater danger. A betrayer could give another signal that would tell them when and where you are going to arrive on Earth, what your trajectory of descent is going to be, that sort of thing.
Who would risk killing the hegemon by downing a shuttle? Said Peter. The world would be outraged, even the people who'd be happy to see me dead.
Anything we do that changes our pattern would let the traitor know his signal was intercepted. It might rush the project, whatever it is, before we're ready. No, I'm sorry to say this, but our best course of action is to wait.
And what if we disagree, said Peter?
Then I'll send you home on the shuttle of your choosing, and pray for you all the way down.
You'd let us go.
You're my guest, said Graf, not my prisoner.
Then let's test it, said Peter. We're leaving on the next shuttle, the one that brought you. When it goes back, we'll be on it.
It's too soon, said Graf. We have no time to prepare.
And neither does he. I suggest, said Peter, that you go to Upanad and make sure he knows he has got to put a complete blanket of secrecy on our imminent departure. He's not even to tell Dimak. But if he's the one, said Mother, then he can't send a signal, said Peter, unless he can find a way to let the information slip out and become public knowledge on the station. That's why it's vital, Minister Graf, that you remain with him at all times after you tell him. So if it's him, he can't send the signal.
But it's probably not him, said Graf, and now you've let everybody know.
But now we'll be watching for the outgoing message.
Unless they simply kill you as you're boarding the shuttle.
Then our worries will be over, said Peter. But I think they won't kill us here, because this agent of theirs is too useful to them, or to Ashil, depending on whose man he is, for them to use him up completely on this operation. Graf pondered this.
So we watch to see who might be sending the message,
and you have agents stationed at the landing point on Earth to see if they can spot a would-be assassin.
I can do that, said Graf. One tiny problem, though.
What's that? Said Peter.
You can't go.
Why can't I? Said Peter.
Because your one-man propaganda campaign is working. The people who read your stuff have drifted more strongly into the anti-China camp. Still a fairly slight movement, but it's real.
I can write my essays there, said Peter.
In danger of being killed at any moment, said Graf.
That could happen here, too, said Peter.
Well, but you yourself said it was unlikely.
Let's catch the mole who's working your station, said Peter, and send him home. Meanwhile, we're heading for Earth. It's been great being here, Minister Graf, but we've got to go. He looked at his mother and father.
Absolutely, said father.
Do you think, said mother, that when we get back to Earth, we can find a place with little tiny beds like these? She clung more tightly to father's arms. It's made us so much closer as a family.
Chapter 15, War Plans. From Demosthenes, Tecumseh at freeamerica.org to Dropbox Feijoada at icomenon.net. Re, 19 characters. Encrypted using code 8 characters. Decrypted using code 11 characters. I spend half my memory capacity just holding on to whatever online identity you're using from week to week. Why not rely on encryption? Nobody's broken hyperprime encryption yet. Here it is, Bean. Those stones in India? Virlomi started it, of course. Got a message from her. Now you are not in cesspool, can communicate again, have no email here. Stones are mine. Back on bridge soon. War in earnest. Post to me only this site. Pick up name Bridge Girl, password not step stool. At least I think that's what stones are mine means. And what does password not step stool mean? That the password is not step stool? Or that the password is not step stool? In which case it's probably not aardvark either, but how does that help? Anyway, I think she's offering to begin war in earnest inside India. She can't possibly have a nationwide network, but then maybe she doesn't need one. She was certainly enough in tune with the Indian people to get them all piling stones in the road, and now the whole stone wall business has taken off. Lots of skirmishes between angry, hungry citizens and Chinese soldiers. Trucks hijacked, sabotage of Chinese offices proceeding apace. What can she do more than is already happening? Given where you are, you may have more need of her information and or help than I do, but I'd appreciate your help understanding the parts of the message that are opaque to me. From Lost Ebo Boy, Navy at icomenon.net to Demosthenes, Tecumseh at freeamerica.org. Re, blank. Encrypted using code 8 characters. Decrypted using code 11 characters. Here's why I keep changing identities. First, they don't have to decrypt the message to get information if they see patterns in our correspondence. It would be useful for them to know the frequency and timing of our correspondence and the length of our messages. Second, they don't have to decrypt the whole message. They only have to guess our encrypt and decrypt codes, which I bet you have written down somewhere because you don't actually care whether I get killed because you're too lazy to memorize. Of course, I mean that in the nicest possible way, O Right Honorable Mr. Hegemon. Here's what Virlomi meant. Obviously, she intended that you not be able to understand the message and correspond with her properly unless you talk to me or Suri. That means she doesn't trust you completely. My guess is that if you wrote to her and left a message using the password not stepstool, she'd know that you hadn't talked to me. You don't know how tempting it was just to leave you with that guess. When we picked her up from that bridge near the Burmese border, she boarded the chopper by stepping on Suryawang's back as he lay prostrate before her. The password is not stepstool. It's the real name of her stepstool. And she's going to be back at that bridge, which means she's made her way across India to the Burmese border, where she'll be in a position to disrupt Chinese supply of their troops in India, or conversely, Chinese attempts to move their troops out of India and back into China or Indochina. Of course, she's only going to be at one bridge, but my guess is that she's already setting up guerrilla groups that are getting ready to disrupt traffic on the other roads between Burma and India, with a strong possibility that she set up something along the Himalayan border as well. I doubt she can seal the borders, but she can slow and harass their passage, tying up troops trying to protect supply lines and making the Chinese less able to mount offensives or keep their troops supplied with ammunition, always a problem for them. Personally, I think you should tell her not to tip her hand too soon. I may be able to tell you when to post a reply asking her to start in earnest on a particular date, and no, I won't post myself because I am most certainly watched here, and I don't want them to know about her directly. I've already caught 2 snoopware intrusions on my desk, which cost me 20 minutes each time, scrambling them so they send back false information to the snoops. Encrypted email like this I can send, but messages posted to dead drops can be picked up by snoopware on the local net. And yes, these are indeed my friends. But they'd be fools not to keep track of what I'm sending out, if they can.
Bean measured himself in the mirror. He still looked like himself, more or less. But he didn't like the way his head was growing. Larger in proportion to his body. Growing faster. I should be getting smarter, shouldn't I? More brain space and all. Instead, I'm worrying about what will happen when my head gets too big. My skull and brains too heavy for my neck to hold the whole assemblage in a vertical position. He measured himself against the coat closet, too. Not all that long ago, he had to stand on tiptoe to reach coat hangers. Then it became easy. Now he was reaching a bit downward from shoulder height. Door frames were not a problem yet, but he was beginning to feel as though he should duck. Why should his growth be accelerating now? He already hit the puberty rush. Petra staggered past him, went into the bathroom, and puked up nothing for about 5 agonizing minutes. They should have drugs for that, he told her afterward. They do, said Petra. But nobody knows how they might affect the baby. There have been no studies? Impossible. No studies on how they might affect your children. Anton's key is just a couple of code spots on the genome. Genes often do double and triple duty, or more. And the baby probably doesn't even have Anton's key. And it's not healthy for the baby if you can't keep any food down. This won't last forever, said Petra. And I'll get fed intravenously if I have to. I'm not doing anything to endanger this baby, Bean. Sorry if my puking ruins your appetite for breakfast. Nothing ruins my appetite for breakfast, said Bean. I'm a growing boy. She retched again. Sorry, said Bean. I don't do this, she whispered miserably, because your jokes are so bad. No, said Bean. It's 'cause my genes are. She retched again, and he left the room, feeling guilty about leaving, but knowing he'd be useless if he stayed. She wasn't one of those people who need petting when they're sick. She preferred to be left alone in her misery. It was one of the ways they were alike. Sort of like injured animals that slink off into the woods to get better, or die, alone. Eli was waiting for him in the large conference room. Chairs were gathered around a large holo on the floor, where a map was being projected of the terrain and militarily significant roads of India and western China. By now the others were used to seeing Bean there, though there were some who still didn't like it. But the Caliph wanted him there. The Caliph trusted him. They watched as the known locations of Chinese garrison troops were brought up in blue, and then the probable locations of mobile forces and reserves in green. When he first saw this map, Bean made the faux pas of asking where they were getting their information. He was informed, quite coldly, that both Persia and the Israeli-Egyptian consortium had active satellite placement programs, and their spy satellites were the best in orbit. "We can get the blood type of individual enemy soldiers," said Ali with a smile. An exaggeration, of course. But then Bean wondered, some kind of spectroanalysis of their sweat? Not possible. Ali was joking, not boasting. Now Bean trusted their information as much as they did, because, of course, he had made discreet inquiries through Peter and through some of his own connections. Putting together what Vlad could tell him from Russian intelligence and what crazy Tom was giving him from England, plus Peter's American sources, it was clear that the Muslims, the Crescent League, had everything the others had, and more. The plan was simple. Massive troop movements along the border between India and Pakistan, bringing Iranian troops up to the front. This should draw a strong Chinese response, with their troops also concentrated along that border. Meanwhile, Turkic forces were already in place on, and sometimes inside, China's western border, having traveled over the past few months in disguise as nomads. On paper, the western region of China looked like ideal country for tanks and trucks. But in reality, fuel supply lines would be a recurring nightmare. So the first wave of Turks would enter as cavalry, switching to mechanized transport only when they were in a position to steal and use Chinese equipment. This was the most dangerous aspect of the plan, Bean knew. The Turkic armies, combining forces from the Hellespont to the Aral Sea and the foothills of the Himalayas, were equipped like raiders, yet had to do the job of an invading army. They had a couple of advantages that might compensate for their lack of armor and air support. Having no supply lines meant the Chinese wouldn't have anything to bomb at first. The native people of the western China province of Xinjiang were Turkic too, and like the Tibetans, they had never stopped seething under the rule of Han China. Above all, the Turks would have surprise and numbers on their side during the crucial first days. The Chinese garrison troops were all massed on the border with Russia. Until those forces could be moved, the Turks should have an easy time, striking anywhere they wanted, taking out police and supply stations, and with luck, every airfield in Xinjiang. By the time Chinese troops moved off the Russian border and into the interior to deal with the Turks, the fully mechanized Turkish troops would be entering China from the west. Now there would be supply lines to attack, but deprived of their forward air bases and forced to face Turkish fighters which would now be using them, China would not have clear air superiority. Taking under-defended air bases with cavalry was just the sort of touch Bean would have expected from Ali. They could only hope that Hanza would not anticipate Ali having complete authority over the inevitable Muslim move. But the Chinese would have to be crazy not to be planning to defend against a Muslim invasion. At some point, it was hoped that the Turks would do well enough that the Chinese would be forced to begin shifting troops from India north into Xinjiang. Here, the terrain favored Ali's plan, for while some Chinese troops could be airlifted over the Tibetan Himalayas, the Tibetan roads would be disrupted by Turkic demolition teams, and the Chinese troops would all have to be moved eastward from India, around the Himalayas, and into western China from the east rather than the south. It would take days, and when the Muslims believed that the maximum number of Chinese troops were in transit, where they could not fight anybody, they would launch the massive invasion over the border between Pakistan and India. So much depended on what the Chinese believed. At first, the Chinese had to believe that the real assault would come from Pakistan, so that the main Chinese force would remain tied up on that frontier. Then, at a crucial point several days into the Turkic operation, the Chinese had to be convinced that the Turkic front was, in fact, the real invasion. They had to be so convinced of this that they would withdraw troops from India, weakening their forces there. How else does an inexperienced 3-million-man army defeat an army of 10 million veterans? They went through contingency plans for the several days following the commitment of Muslim troops in Pakistan. But Bean knew, as did Ali, that nothing that happened after the Muslim troops began crossing the Indian border could be predicted. They had plans in case the invasion failed utterly, and Pakistan had to be protected at fallback positions well inside the Pakistani border. They had plans for dealing with a complete rout of the Chinese forces. Not likely, as they knew. But in the most likely scenario, a difficult back-and-forth battle across a 1,000-mile front, plans would have to be improvised to take advantage of every turn of events. "So," said Ali, "that is the plan. Any comments?" Around the circle, one officer after another voiced his measured confidence. This was not because they were all yes-men, but because Ali had already listened carefully to the objections they raised before and had altered the plans to deal with those he thought were serious problems. Only one of the Muslims offered any objection today, and it was the one non-military man, Lenkovsky, whose role, as best Bean could tell, was halfway between minister without portfolio and chaplain. "I think it is a shame," he said, "that our plans are so dependent upon what Russia chooses to do." Bean knew what he meant. Russia was completely unpredictable in this situation. On the one hand, the Warsaw Pact had a treaty with China that had secured China's long northern border with Russia, freeing them to conquer India in the first place. On the other hand, the Russians and Chinese had been rivals in this region for centuries, and each believed the other held territory that was rightfully theirs. And there were unpredictable personal issues as well. How many loyal servants of Ashil were still in positions of trust and authority in Russia? At the same time, many Russians were furious at how they had been used by him before he went to India and then China. Yet Ashil brokered the secret treaty between Russia and China, so he couldn't be all that detested, could he? But what was that treaty really worth? Every Russian schoolchild knew that the stupidest Russian czar of them all had been Stalin, because he made a treaty with Hitler's Germany and then expected it to be kept. Surely the Russians did not really believe China would stay at peace with them forever. So there was always the chance that Russia, seeing China at a disadvantage, would join the fray. The Russians would see it as a chance to seize territory and to preempt the inevitable Chinese betrayal of them. That would be a good thing, if the Russians attacked in force but were not terribly successful. It would bleed Chinese troops from the battle against the Muslims. But it would be a very bad thing if Russia did too well or too badly. Too well, and they might slice down through Mongolia and seize Beijing. Then the Muslim victory would become a Russian one. Ali did not want to have Russia in a dominant role in the peace negotiations. And if Russia entered the war but lost quickly, Chinese troops would not have to watch the Russian border. Free to move, those garrison troops might be hurled against the Turks, or they might be sent through Russian territory to strike into Kazakhstan, threatening to cut off Turkish supply lines. That was why Ali had expressed his hope that the Russians would be too surprised to do anything at all. "There's no helping it," said Ali. "We have done all we can do. What Russia does is in the hands of God." "May I speak?" said Bean. Ali nodded. All eyes turned to him. At previous meetings, Bean had said nothing, preferring to talk with Ali in private, where he did not risk committing an error in the way he spoke to the caliph. "When you have committed to battle," said Bean, "I believe I can use my own contacts and persuade the hegemon to use his to urge Russia to pursue whatever course you think most advisable." Several of the men shifted uncomfortably in their chairs. "Please reassure my worried friends here," said Ali, "that you have not already been in discussion with the hegemon or anyone else about our plans." "The opposite is true," said Bean. "You are the ones who are preparing to take action. I have been providing you with all the information I learned from them." "But I know these people and what they can do. The hegemon has no armies, but he does have great influence on world opinion. Of course, he will speak in favor of your action, but he also has influence inside Russia, which he could use either to urge intervention or to argue against it. My friends, also. Bean knew that Alai knew that the only friend worth mentioning was Vlad, and Vlad had been the only one of the kidnapped members of Ender's Jeesh to join with Ashiel and take his side. Whether that had been because he had truly become a follower of Ashiel, or because he thought Ashiel was acting in the interest of Mother Russia, Bean still had not figured out. Vlad provided him with information sometimes, but Bean always looked for a second source before he fully trusted it. "Then I will tell you this," said Alai. "Today, I don't know what would be more useful, for Russia to join in the attack or for Russia to stand by doing nothing. As long as they don't attack us, I'll be content. But as events unfold, the picture may become clearer." Bean did not need to point out to Alai that Russia would not enter the war to rescue a failing Muslim invasion. Only if the Russians scented victory would they put their own forces at risk. So if Alai waited too long to ask for help, it would not come. They took a break for the noon meal, but it was very brief, and when they returned to the conference room, the map had changed. There was a third part of the plan, and Bean knew that this was the one that Alai was least certain about. For months now, Arab armies from Egypt, Iraq, and every other Arab nation had been transported on oil tankers from Arab ports to Indonesia. The Indonesian Navy was one of the most formidable in the world, and its carrier-based air force was the only one in the region that rivaled the Chinese in equipment and armament. Everyone knew that it was because of the Indonesian umbrella that the Chinese had not taken Singapore or ventured into the Philippines. Now it was proposed that the Indonesian Navy be used to transport a combined Arab-Indonesian army to effect a landing in Thailand or Vietnam. Both nations were filled with people who longed for deliverance from the Chinese conquerors. When the plans for the two possible landing sites had been fully laid out, Alai did not ask for criticisms. He had his own. "I think in both cases, our plans for the landing are excellent. My misgiving is the same one I've had all along. There is no serious military objective there to be achieved. The Chinese can afford to lose battle after battle there, using only their available forces, retreating farther and farther, while waiting to see the outcome of the real war. I think the soldiers we sent there would risk dying for no good purpose. It's too much like the Italian campaign in World War II. Long, slow, costly, and ineffective, even if we win every battle." The Indonesian commander bowed his head. "I am grateful for the Caliph's concern for the lives of our soldiers, but the Muslims of Indonesia could not bear to stand by while their brothers fight. If these objectives are meaningless, find us something meaningful to do." One of the Arab officers added his agreement. "We've committed our troops to this operation. Is it too late, then, to bring them back and let them join with the Pakistanis and Iranians in the liberation of India? Their numbers might make a crucial difference there." "The time draws close for the weather to be at its best for our purposes," said Alai. "There's no time to bring back the Arab armies. But I can see no value in sending soldiers into battle for no better reason than solidarity, or delaying the invasion in order to bring the Arab armies into a different theater of war. If it was a mistake to send them to Indonesia, the mistake is my own." They murmured their disagreement. They could not agree with blaming the Caliph for any mistakes. At the same time, Bean knew that they appreciated knowing they were led by a man who did not blame others. It was part of the reason they loved him. Alai spoke over their objections. "I have not decided yet whether to launch the Third Front. But if we do launch it, then the objective we should plan for is Thailand, not Vietnam. I realize the risks of leaving the fleet exposed for a longer time at sea. We will have to count on the Indonesian pilots to protect their ships. I choose Thailand because it is a more coherent country, with terrain more suitable for a swift conquest. In Vietnam, we would have to fight for every inch of territory, and our progress would look slow on the map. The Chinese would feel safe. In Thailand, our progress will look very quick and dangerous. As long as they forget that Thailand is not important to them in the overall war, it might cause them to send troops there to oppose us. After a few more niceties, the meeting ended. One thing that no one mentioned was the actual date of the invasion. Bean was sure that one had been chosen and that everyone in the room but him knew what it was. He accepted that. It was the one piece of information which he had no need to know, and the most crucial one to withhold from him if he could not be trusted after all. Back in their room, Bean found Petra asleep. He sat down and used his desk to access his email and check a few sites on the nets. He was interrupted by a light knock on the door. Petra was instantly awake. Pregnant or not, she still slept like a soldier, and she was at the door before Bean could shut down his connection and step away from the table. Lankovsky stood there, looking apologetic and regal, a combination that only he could have mastered. "If you will forgive me," he said, "our mutual friend wishes to speak with you in the garden." "Both of us?" asked Petra. "Please, unless you are too ill." Soon they were seated on the bench beside Eli's garden throne, though, of course, he never called it that, referring to it only as a chair. "I'm sorry, Petra, that I couldn't bring you into the meeting. Our Crescent League is not recidivist, but it would make some of them too uncomfortable to have a woman present at such meetings." "Eli, do you think I don't know that?" she said. "You have to deal with the culture around you." "I assume that Bean has acquainted you with our plans." "I was asleep when he returned to the room," said Petra. "So anything that's changed since last time, I don't know." "I'm sorry then, but perhaps you can pick up what's happening from the context, because I know Bean has something to say, and he didn't say it yet." "I saw no flaw in your plans," said Bean. "I think you've done everything that could possibly be done, including being smart enough not to think you can plan what will happen once battle has been joined in India." "But such praise is not what I saw on your face," said Eli. "I didn't think my face was readable," said Bean. "It isn't," said Eli. "That's why I'm asking you." "We've received an offer that I think you'll be glad of," said Bean. "From?" "I don't know if you ever knew Verlomi," said Bean.
"Battle school?"
"Yes."
"Before my time, I think. I was a young boy and paid no attention to girls anyway."
He smiled at Petra.
"Weren't we all?" said Bean. "Verlomi was the one who made it possible for me and Sir Yawong to retrieve Petra from Hyderabad and save the Indian battle school graduates from being slaughtered by Ashiel."
"She has my admiration, then," said Eli.
"She's back in India. All that building of stone obstacles, the so-called Great Wall of India. Apparently she's the one who started that." Now Eli's interest looked like more than mere politeness. "Peter received a message from her. She has no idea about you and what you're doing, and neither does Peter. But she sent the message in language that he couldn't understand without conferring with me. A very careful and wise thing for her to do, I think." They exchanged smiles. "She is in place in the area of a bridge spanning one of the roads between India and Burma. She may be able to disrupt one, many, or even all of the major roads leading between India and China." Eli nodded. "It would be a disaster, of course," said Bean, "if she acted on her own and cut the roads before the Chinese are able to move any troops out of India. In other words, if she thinks the real invasion is the Turkish one, then she might think her most helpful role would be to keep Chinese troops in India. Ideally, what she would do is wait until they start trying to move troops back into India and then cut the roads." keeping them out. But if we tell her, said Alai, and the message is intercepted, then the Chinese will know that the Turkic operation is not the main effort. Well, that's why I didn't want to bring this up in front of the others. I can tell you that I believe communication between her and Peter, and between Peter and me, is secure. I believe that Peter is desperate for your invasion to succeed, and Verlomi will be too, and they will not tell anyone anything that would compromise it. But it's your call. Peter is desperate for our invasion to succeed, asked Alai. Alai, the man's not stupid. I didn't have to tell him about your plans or even that you had plans. He knows that you're here, in seclusion, and he has satellite reports of the troop movements to the Indian frontier. He hasn't discussed it with me, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if he also knew about the Arab presence in Indonesia. That's the kind of thing he always finds out about, because he has contacts everywhere. Sorry to suspect you, said Alai, but I'd be remiss if I didn't. Think about Verlomi anyway, said Bean. It would be tragic if, in her effort to help, she actually hindered your plan. But that's not all you wanted to say, said Alai. No, said Bean, and he hesitated. Go on. Your reason for not wanting to open the Third Front was a sound one, said Bean. Not wanting to waste lives taking militarily unimportant objectives. So you think I shouldn't use that force at all, said Alai. No, said Bean. I think you need to be bolder with them. I think you need to waste more lives on an even more spectacular non-military objective. Alai turned away. I was afraid you'd see that. I was sure you'd already thought of it. I was hoping one of the Arabs or the Indonesians themselves would propose it, said Alai. Propose what? Asked Petra. The military goal, said Bean, is to destroy their armies, which is done by attacking them with superior force, achieving surprise, and cutting off their supply and escape routes. Nothing you do with the Third Front can achieve any of those objectives. I know, said Alai. China isn't a democracy. The government doesn't have to win elections, but they need the support of their people all the more because of that. Petra sighed her understanding. Invade China itself. There is no hope of success in such an invasion, said Alai. On the other fronts, we will have a citizenry that welcomes us and cooperates with us while obstructing them. In China, the opposite would be true. Their air force would be working from nearby airfields and could fly sortie after sortie between each wave of our planes. The potential for disaster would be very great. Plan for disaster, said Bean. Begin with disaster. You're too subtle for me, said Alai. What's disaster in this case? Besides actually getting stopped at the beach? Not likely, since China has one of the most invisible shorelines in the world. The disaster is for your force to be dispersed, cut off from supply, and operating without coordinating central control. Land them, said Alai, and have them immediately begin a guerrilla campaign? But they won't have the support of the people. I thought about this a lot, said Bean. The Chinese people are used to oppression. When have they not been oppressed? But they've never become reconciled to it. Think how many peasant revolts there have been, and against governments far more benign than this one. Now, if your soldiers go into China like Sherman's march to the sea, they'll be opposed at every step. But they have to live off the land if they're cut off from supply, said Alai. Strictly disciplined troops can make this work, said Bean. But this will be hard for the Indonesians, given the way the Chinese have always been regarded within Indonesia itself. Trust me to control my troops. Then here's what they do. In every village they come to, they take half the food, but only half. They make a big point of leaving the rest, and you tell them it's because Allah did not send you to make war against the Chinese people. If you had to kill anybody to get control of the village, apologize to the family or to the whole village if it was a soldier who died. be the nicest invaders they've ever imagined. Oh, said Alai, that's asking a lot from mere discipline. Petra was getting the vision of this. Maybe if you quote to your soldiers that passage from the elevated places, where it says, maybe your lord will destroy your enemy and make you rulers in the land, then he will see how you act. Alai looked at her in genuine consternation. You quote the Quran to me? I thought the verse was appropriate, she said. Isn't that why you had them put it in my room, so I'd read it? Alai shook his head. Lankovsky gave you the Quran. And she read it, added Bean. We're both surprised. It's a good passage to use, said Alai. Maybe God will make us rulers in China. Let's show from the start that we can do it justly and righteously. The best part of the plan, said Bean, is that the Chinese soldiers will come right afterward, and fearing that their own armies will be left without supplies, or in the effort to deprive your army of further provender, they will probably seize all the rest of the food. Alai nodded, smiled, then laughed. Our invading army leaves the Chinese people enough to eat, but the Chinese army makes them starve. The likelihood of a public relations victory is very high, said Bean. And meanwhile, said Petra, the Chinese soldiers in India and Xinjiang are going crazy because they don't know what's going on with their families back home. The invasion fleet doesn't mass for the attack, said Bean. It's done in Filipino and Indonesian fishing boats, small forces up and down the coast. The Indonesian fleet, with its carriers, waits far offshore until they're called in on air strikes against identified military targets. Every time they try to find your army, you melt away. No pitched battles. At first, the people will help them. Soon enough, the people will help you. You resupply with ammunition and demolition equipment by airdrops at night. Food they find for themselves. And all the time, they move farther and farther inland, destroying communications, blowing up bridges. No dams, though. Leave the dams alone. Of course, said Alai darkly. We remember Aswan. Anyway, that was my suggestion, said Bean. Militarily, it does nothing for you during the first weeks. The attrition rate will be high at first, until the teams get in from the coast and get used to this kind of combat. But if even a quarter of your contingents are able to remain free and effective, operating inside China, it will force the Chinese to bring more and more troops home from the Indian front. Until they sue for peace, said Alai. We don't actually want to rule over China. We want to liberate India and Indochina, bring back all the captives taken into China, and restore the rightful governments, but with a treaty allowing complete privileges to Muslims within their borders. So much bloodshed for such a modest goal, said Petra. And, of course, the liberation of Turkic China, said Alai. They'll like that, said Bean. And Tibet, said Alai. Humiliate them enough, said Petra, and you've merely set the stage for the next war, and complete freedom of religion in China as well. Petra laughed. It's going to be a long war, Alai. The new empire, they'd probably give up. They haven't held it that long, and it's not as if it brought them great wealth and honor. But they've held Tibet and Turkic China for centuries. There are Han Chinese all over both territories. Those are problems to be solved later, said Alai, and not by you. Probably not by me either. But we know what the West keeps forgetting. If you win, win. I think that approach was proven a disaster at Versailles. No, said Alai. It was only proven a disaster after Versailles, when France and England didn't have the spine, didn't have the will to compel obedience to the treaty. After World War II, the Allies were wiser. They had left their troops on German soil for nearly a century. In some cases benignly, in some cases brutally, but always definitely there. As you said, Bean answered, You and your successors will find out how well this works, and how to solve the new problems that are bound to come up. But I warn you now, that if liberators turn out to be oppressors, the people they liberated will feel even more betrayed and hate them worse. I'm aware of that, said Ali, and I know what you're warning me of. I think, said Bean, that you won't know whether the Muslim people have actually changed from the bad old days of religious intolerance until you put power in their hands. What the Caliph can do, said Ali, I will do. I know you will, said Petra. I don't envy you your responsibility. Ali smiled. Your friend Peter does. In fact, he wants more. And your people, said Bean, will want more on your behalf. You may not want to rule the world, but if you win in China, they'll want you to, in their name. And at that point, Ali, how can you tell them no? With these lips, said Ali, and this heart.